The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Living Well into the Future with your host, Julie B. Adler. We invite you to join us in our continuing investigation of resilience as we speak with solution makers who engage with issues vital to our future. Food, housing, climate, and health. In this episode, we will be looking at how individuals can survive and thrive after the devastating impact of broadly felt disasters such as 9/11, COVID, and life-threatening hurricanes, all of which affect not only the individual, but entire communities, our nation, and the world. We hope that the knowledge of efforts and action by our guests will give our listeners insights into how to build resilience or be resilient when faced with traumatic events or circumstances in the future. Write to us to let us know if this or any of our other episodes have given rise to discussions or actions on your part. Let us know which episodes were relevant to your life, what other topics you might like us to cover. You can reach us through our website, livingwellintothefuture.net, where you can get more information about our guests, show notes, and information about past episodes. Or you can write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com.
Welcome. I'm your host, Julie B. Adler. For the last several months, we've been talking and thinking about resilience. Listeners have told me that the episodes have triggered discussions with friends and family. That's our goal. Please continue letting us know about discussions, how what our guests have talked about has resonated with you, what thoughts or actions they may have provoked. Today, we'll be speaking with two guests who have experience in tackling and surviving the traumatic days of 9/11, COVID, and the devastating effects of flooding from hurricanes. A third guest will speak with us about the actions that he and his firms are taking to prevent the kind of devastation that we see. F. Diane Barth, who you have heard in an earlier program, worked with individuals and groups after 9/11 and through COVID. Diane, a licensed clinical social worker, is a psychotherapist and analyst in private practice in New York City and Massachusetts. She has been on the faculty and supervisory staff and a training analyst at the Psychoanalytic Institute of the Postgraduate Center. Currently, she teaches private study groups and runs workshops around the country. She's written widely in professional journals, articles, provided chapters, written books, and has a popular blog on Psychology Today, Off the Couch, and on Substack, Aging Without a Map. Our second guest is Patty Denenberg, a lifelong resident of Houston, Texas. As we're producing this episode, residents of the Southeast are still responding to the effects of Hurricane Helene, with Hurricane Milton on its way. Both are capable and have rendered the kind of devastation Patty knows all too well. If you'd like to make contributions to organizations involved in current relief efforts, we will put a list of those organizations into our show notes. While extreme weather events are the norm in Houston, Patty felt secure in her home located within a 500-year floodplain, with the chance of a once-in-500-year event happening slim. That changed in 2015, with three devastating floods, culminating in 2017 with the killer Hurricane Harvey. Here's how Patty describes her experiences.
The first would be what is called the Memorial Day flood in Houston, which happened in 2015, which was the biggest flood. 12 months later was the Tax Day flood on April 15th. And then a year and 2 months later was the whopper Hurricane Harvey, which did everybody in. But the Memorial Day flood was the first one, which was so bad. Never seen anything they prepare and they talk, and the news media, and it's all that they talk about. The grocery stores were empty. People were hoarding food and hoarding everything that you could get your hands on. And the day before was absolutely beautiful with blue skies and no humidity here in this city. And then all of a sudden, the Memorial Day flood comes, and we got about 25 inches of water. And when it's water in your house, it doesn't matter if it's an inch or two, or if it's 3 feet, 4 feet. And it wasn't rainwater, it's bayou water, because I'm surrounded by bayous. And that's the water that flooded all of our homes.
For our third guest, we turn to Alex Ramirez, a landscape architect who is a principal in the award-winning landscape architecture firm Design Workshop, with projects around the country and abroad. As you will hear from Alex in Houston, he and his firm are working to increase resiliency one project at a time. Longtime listeners of Living Well into the Future may remember episode 16, Beyond Sustainability, when we spoke about regenerative practices that actively contribute to a thriving planet. One of our guests was Heather Venhouse of Regenerative Environmental Design. She told us about the Midtown Houston project that was developed with resilient design in mind. Alex's firm, Design Workshop, provided the landscape architecture services for that project.
Landscape architects as a whole have a lot to deal with and a lot to consider with respect to resiliency. How do you define resiliency? What does resiliency mean to you? And then what does resiliency mean to our clients and to the people who hire us to do work? And so I think depending on that definition and who is helping you define that for a given project depends on our approach and how deep we might get into those conversations and some of the strategies that we might develop going forward. So Design Workshop has worked on resiliency here in the Gulf Coast region with respect to storms and droughts and things like that. The West Coast offices have dealt with resiliency in a different way with respect to wildfires and making plans around that. For us, it's one issue, one problem. On the West Coast, it's a little bit different. They deal with droughts and wildfires, and so that approach is different than what we think about here. I think because we've been around for over 50 years, we have a wide range of knowledge from the experts we have in our offices and the consultants that we've worked with over the years. I think it affords us the opportunity to look at things holistically, step back and plan regionally, but also be able to get down into the nitty-gritty of a specific site, make recommendations for improvements in an urban park, in a street corridor, in an arboretum. So you can start tackling the problem on a case-by-case basis. It's too hard to make a regional plan and dedicate millions of dollars to implement a huge plan. It has to be done on a case-by-case. It's about how can the sum of each project create a greater whole. And so as landscape architects, I think we're all pulling the same direction. And we all have different opportunities to make an impact in our communities. And I think it goes without saying that it's part of our responsibility to have that on the forefront of our mind and make sure the end product that we deliver to our clients respects all of those things and the challenges that we deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Now that you've been introduced to our guests, let's hear more from Diane Barth. Welcome, Diane Barth. In your practice in New York City, you worked with individuals and groups traumatized by 9/11 and COVID. And what we're trying to do in this podcast is to look at these unexpected events in our past and try and find out what we can learn from them as we move into the future. So through your experience working with groups and individuals who have been exposed to these situations, I'm hoping that our audience can find some guidance on achieving resilience in the future. Can you tell us what school or kind of therapy you practice?
I have become an integrator, so I don't actually practice specifically psychoanalysis anymore. We have so many different kinds of therapy these days that it's really easy to use a lot of different tools. And so I work with a lot of different tools that I always bring in under an umbrella of understanding that there is often some underlying meaning to our difficulties or a way of organizing our lives, but that it's not always useful to try to dig into those meanings. It's sometimes useful to do things like learning to be mindful or learning to do breath work or do some body work without necessarily trying to dig up what happened in your childhood that you're not remembering or that caused certain kinds of interactions to happen. On the other hand, sometimes looking at those things can be useful. I also look at the underlying meanings of here and now kinds of interactions with people. So sometimes your feelings get hurt. It's not because of something your mother did 100,000 years ago. It's something that's going on between you and the friend who hurt your feelings. And that can be unpacked and understood, and then you can work on what to do with it. So there is not a label for the kind of integrative sort of work that I do, but I pull in from a lot of different approaches.
In our past three episodes, we've been talking about resilience to communities and more to systems through economic development, through education, through resilience justice, and looking at how communities can adapt and thrive. In this episode, we're talking about individual resilience. What would be your definition of resilience in this case?
Okay. I actually think it's probably very similar because to me, resilience is about adapting. It's about adapting to trauma, to difficult situations, unexpected events in one's life, failures in one's life, and also often adapting to life not living up to your expectation.
With that definition in mind, I'd like to speak to you about 9/11. You worked with both individuals and groups of people. Could you first talk about the individuals?
Yes, I worked with people I had already been working with who were traumatized. It was a terrible time, very distressing for everyone in New York and all over the country. Some of my current clients were working in or near the World Trade Towers. Some saw the events in real life. Some of them were in Brooklyn, but saw the events, saw the smoke, and I think some actually even saw the planes. I also worked with new clients who had suffered trauma from, again, either seeing the events or being in a spot where it had happened or just being in New York at the time. I also worked with a couple of people who were out of New York during the time, but were New Yorkers, and that there was trauma for them at not being part of the community. I'm going to give you a more general response to what you asked me, but what that all comes down to is that the things that create resilience, there's a genetic component, there's a how you grew up component, but there's also a component that has to do with your ability to learn how to cope with tragedy and trauma. And one of the things that the research shows that makes a huge difference is being able to be part of a support community. For example, the people who were out of the city and felt cut off from their friends and their community suffered a lot. That some of the people that I worked with in the city, even though they'd had more immediate trauma, so to speak, didn't suffer because they had a community of people who were going through the same thing, who were supporting each other, who were able to just talk through some of the events together.
You've mentioned genetic predisposition and upbringing and community. Is there a way to build those things prophylactically?
So you can't become an optimist if you're not an optimist. But we know from all of the different kinds of therapies that are going on these days, that you can change your patterns. And the changing patterns are apparently, I don't know that there's MRI evidence, but essentially we can change the way our brain works so that you may not be an optimist, but you can have a conversation with yourself where you have an Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh point of view where everything is bad, nothing good is going to happen, it's just going to be terrible. You can learn to have conversations with that part of your brain that go, yes, pretty lousy, but what else can we do to make it a little better for right now? And over time, if you practice that kind of conversation of looking for something that can be pulled out of the difficult situation, your brain patterns will change. It's not as easy as I just made it sound, but that process can involve learning some mindfulness techniques, learning some breath work techniques, learning some ways to relax your body. Also, taking care of yourself just physically can help with that. So there's something called learned optimism. I'm not sure I really believe in that. I don't think you can truly become optimistic if you're not. But you can learn resilience. You can learn that one of the things that research has shown is that we actually would never grow if we didn't have bad things happen to us. So we learn from difficult and unpleasant experiences. So even if you are not an optimist, even if you are a negative thinker, you can say to yourself, what can I learn from this situation? What can I do that can make it a little different? I learned a huge amount working with people during both of these incidents. But during COVID, one of the things I learned was that some people were able to say, okay, this is awful. I can't stand the fact that I can't go out. I can't be with anybody. I can't do the things I like to do. But what can I do to make this as good as it can be? And people were so creative in what they developed in terms of internet pods and communities and people with young children finding ways to have a group of young children that their children could associate with, who just that's all they associated with. Or older men and women whose grown children came back home used it as an opportunity to spend time with their children that they knew they would never get again and that they would not have gotten if it hadn't been for COVID. That didn't make COVID better. COVID was a terrible time. And that's part of resilience. You have to acknowledge how bad things can be and how that you're suffering. But you can learn to find ways to cope with it. That's not just coping. That's also about turning it to your advantage.
So that's adaptation.
Exactly.
You worked with groups after 9/11.
9/11, yes.
Does it work differently for people who seek treatment or are members of group? Can you address a group in a healing way to increase resilience?
You can, for sure, if the members of the group want to be there and are looking for that. What we learned in 9/11 was that not everybody can be treated for trauma in the same way. Some got better on their own. Some got better in their family group. Some loved having a group of other people to share the experience with, and some hated that. And in fact, what we found was that some of the techniques that we thought were supposed to be useful for dealing with trauma, like getting somebody to talk about the situation, actually made things worse for some people. What we learned is that all of our tools can be useful for some people, and some of our tools are not useful and can even be harmful for some people, and some don't need therapists at all. That's always been true. Therapists are not necessary for the whole world. For people who find it useful, then yes, of course, it's useful.
Do different situations require building different kinds of resilience?
So you asked us several really important questions. So one is, it is absolutely not a one-size-fits-all. That's something that every therapist and every individual has to learn and every community has to learn. In some cases, building resilience comes from the community itself. In some cases, building resilience is all that's needed is somebody to say, oh my God, I am so sorry you're going through this. Let me give you a dress that, you know, or a jacket or something that, or, you know, or blankets and a pillow. In some cases, it's just the feeling that somebody knows what you're feeling and is able to give you something that can stimulate a person's internal ability to adapt. In some cases, it's more than that is required, but there's no single size fits all. Having said that, I think we are getting better at adapting because we now expect things to happen. We are not living in a bubble where we think nothing can happen to us. We've had enough things going on. We have incredible service organizations that help people out, that are available, trained, ready for emergencies, which we had before, but they weren't on the spot the way they are now. That adds to resilience, the feeling that there is a support there. There's somebody who can help, may not be immediately, but that there's somebody there to help. We also understand so much more about grief than we maybe ever have. And so helping people grieve in their own way with support when asked for or necessary is really important. We have tools for dealing with people who can't get thoughts out of their head. We have a lot of things that we didn't used to have. And what's important is that people be encouraged to find somebody who can help them and be encouraged to know if what that person is offering is useful for them or not useful. You don't have to take something if it's not useful to you. That's part of adapting, is to be able to say, this doesn't work for me. And then there's another piece that you didn't ask me about, but which has been coming up more. The first articles about it started with Katrina, but they've come up now with all of these more recent catastrophes, which is that therapists are going through the same traumas. We have to acknowledge we don't have to acknowledge with clients all the time, although some people actually find it helpful, but some don't. But we have to be able to really own for ourselves that this is a traumatic time for us, and to know how to get the help we need to be able to process our feelings and process the events and in order to provide whatever it is we have to provide for clients.
The 9/11 situation and the hurricane situations and the COVID situations elicit different reactions and demand Yes. different responses. Could you explain that?
Sure. So there are a couple of things. It's easy to find an enemy and then become sure that the enemy is the cause of all the problems. If you find an enemy and they're the cause of the problems, I think anytime we do that, anytime we start to split the humanity into the good guys and the bad guys, we lose a part of our ability to get better. The motivation for that is part of what makes people able to adapt, which is the motivation to have a community, to have people that we feel connected to and supported by, and to use that to build our own strength. So I think that the work often in any kind of situation like this, and one of the lessons that it's important to have learned, is that the more you can build a community rather than tearing down a community, the more adaptive you're going to be. And that goes also to the point that I think I was making before, that if we stop thinking that this should not have happened, and we start to think, okay, it happened, it is terrible, I'm grieving, I'm hurting, people I love are grieving, are hurting, but we accept it, then we are able to delve into our own strengths and help people delve into their strengths to take action, which is extremely important, to change things. And the more we can take action to change things or to make things different so that next time, maybe it doesn't happen quite the same way, the better prepared we are, the less we feel like victims, and the more we feel like we have some sense of agency, some sense of, we don't have control over these things, but we have control over a response to them. Personal agency is extremely important to resilience, and it doesn't mean that we can change events. It means, why don't we have some control over in some small way in the here and now? What little things can we do? A lot of times for a lot of people, that was doing something for somebody else. A wonderful example I have is there were people who developed online scavenger hunts during COVID, and they brought in a whole community of friends, acquaintances, other people they didn't even know, but it provided a very funny opportunity to connect with other people, to be silly, to have fun at a time where it was a little hard to have those kinds of experiences. And it wasn't just for the person who was developing the scavenger hunt. It was for everybody else who got involved and gave her a tremendous sense of agency and also a sense of having done something nice for other people. And that's also really important in developing agency and of taking action.
Indeed. You have given us a lot to think about and tools that really anyone could develop if they think about it. It's many sizes fits all, but it's a kind of overarching framework.
It's also really important to be able to say that you need help, that you can't do some of these things by yourself. And that's, there's no shame to it. There's no weakness to it. It's what I was talking about for us therapists. We were having group meetings all through COVID where we were providing support for each other because it was so difficult to do this work on our own. And we were dealing with our own stuff also. So there's nothing wrong, nothing at all weak or negative about being able to say, I need some help to do these things.
Well, terrific. Thank you, Diane Barth, for speaking with me.
Thank you, Julie. This was fun.
Now that you have heard Diane's account of working through trauma to resilience with her clients, we'll hear from Patty Denenberg, whose resilience through a series of traumatic weather events demonstrate many of the elements that Diane described.
Welcome, Patty Denenberg, to Living Well into the Future. You grew up in Houston. Do you still have friends and family in the area?
Oh, absolutely. There's about 26 of us of my immediate family, and we're all within 15, 20 minutes apart. So not very far at all. Friends in the neighborhood that I grew up with, a lot of them on my block, on the one block over, a ton of people that I went to school with and grew up with still live here and raised their families here.
Are you surrounded by water?
Surrounded by bayous.
Could you describe bayous for people who don't live in Houston?
Bayou runs through the city. There are thousands of them here. And they're a way to collect extra water. They're very prominent in Houston. And when it floods, that's what floods. The water runs over and they're not clean.
How often has your neighborhood been affected by hurricanes and just flooding from heavy rains that you remember?
Three times.
Those are the three events that you described that occurred from 2015 to 2017.
Did you have memories of a hurricane growing up?
You always, living in Houston, hear about hurricanes. The media makes such a big deal about it. The grocery stores run out of food and supplies and flashlights and batteries. And yeah, you lost power for, you know, a day or two, but nothing that was life-altering, nothing at all.
Do you remember your parents taking precautions?
I do. I have a memory of a childhood home. I must have been about 10. A big glass window that looked out into the backyard and my parents taping it up all which ways, sideways and diagonal, I guess, to save the window. Or I don't know if that would have worked at Harvey. I didn't do that. We learned our own tricks, doing things that we did. Preparing, but that's how they prepared 50 years ago.
And did they stock up?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Can openers and canned food and batteries and flashlights.
This is something that everybody knows.
Oh, everybody. Yeah, but they weren't life altering. They came, they went, big deals were made about them coming. And fortunately, I can't recall any death that occurred during them. You did take safety and precautions and you weren't out on the roads and stuff, but nothing like what's happened here in the past 10 years.
Let's go to the three events beginning in 2015 that you talked about at the beginning of the program, culminating in Hurricane Harvey.
What damage did you incur in the first two?
The first one was much worse than the second one. The first one totally took my house apart. Again, we got feet of water in our house, dirty water. And had to rip out our entire walls up to 5 feet. We live in such a humid climate. We all have mold in our house. You just deal with it. But when water gets in your house, you have to tear your walls down. The first one was major. For about 30 hours, the rain was like a cloud that sat above Meyerland, and it just didn't stop. And there was nowhere for it to go. And so it eventually came into all of our homes. We were the one part of town that was just devastated. And then about a week later, on the north side of town, they opened up levees or dams and let people know, you're going to flood. We're opening these up. Be prepared. And these are people that don't or didn't at the time, and probably still don't, live in flood zones. So they did not have flood insurance. And they were given 5-7 days notice that we're going to flood your home because we've got to do something with this water. And sure enough, an area specifically that I know of called Bear Creek just underwater for no reason other than they had nowhere for this water to go, nothing to do with it.
Could you prepare for this event?
Yeah, we did silly things. No one in their right mind thought that we were going to get the kind of damage that we did. We bought this massive green bean cans and lifted all of our furniture and put them on these cans to get them a foot and a half up off the ground, which did no good. Nothing. But that's what we were prepared for because we didn't know. We had never experienced anything like it until the second one. Then we knew what we were looking at and what to do.
So you had repaired once?
Oh, not repaired. Totally gutted my house and started over. 100%.
Furniture and
everything. Everything.
But you thought it was a one-time thing that it would
happen again. Of course. I live in a 500-year floodplain. It's never going to happen again. And second time, put back hardwood floors, thinking, why, of course, why wouldn't I? And a year later, it flooded again, and my hardwood floors just picked themselves up.
Was the second time a hurricane or a flood?
A flood. And it was the tax day flood and didn't do as much damage, but it doesn't matter if you've got 5 feet of water or a foot of water. You're in the same trouble. You may not have lost the same amount of possessions, but your house was damaged to the same extent. You got to tear down your walls. You got to start over. You've lost every bed. You've lost every piece of upholstered furniture, every piece of wood furniture, because there's mold on everything.
At that point, did you put in a generator?
No. After the second one, we put our house back together again.
And again, what did you think?
This is it.
It couldn't
happen again. And my family's, how do you get out? I'm like, I can't. I've got a mortgage. Where am I going to go? No, my house is worth nothing. On HCAD, my dwelling was valued at $100. I had to put it back together. So I walk away from my mortgage and now I'm in trouble because I can never buy another house. I have nowhere to go. Or I put my house back together. And that's what we did.
And then what happened?
Harvey came. That was the killer. That was the nail in the coffin. That was the worst, where people were stuck in their attics. Both my boys were living at home. My younger son had what I would call a major panic attack. And I had to be strong and trust that we were going to be okay. My house was flat roof, and he ran outside, jumped the fence, and got on top of the roof thinking I could get everybody up here. And while he was up there, he looked over at our neighbor and realized, oh, wow. We could all go here. They have this massive veranda out front. It's 8, 9, 10 stairs to get to their front door. And that's where we ended up.
And neighbors were very accommodating.
Very much.
When you left the house, could you secure it?
No, we couldn't even shut the door because there was water. There was nothing to secure. There was nothing to...
So had there been evacuation notices prior to...
Yeah. No, we definitely would have left.
It seems as if your neighbors were very welcoming.
And then some, yeah.
So how long before you could get out of your neighborhood?
We were probably next door for not quite 2 full days. No, yeah. There were like 6 families. I was the only one with kids at the time, but there were 6 families, including us, and there was nothing to do. You just sat around and waited. And boats came by, canoes and little Howard fishing boats would come by and check. And we're all sitting outside. Are y'all okay? Do y'all need anything? And we were fine. We just waited it out.
Did local and federal workers help?
FEMA was here and FEMA helped. We became best friends on a day-to-day basis. We talked. But my file with FEMA was so big by that third flood that I knew their number by heart. There was an apartment complex going up about a mile from my house that was a mid-rise. It hadn't even opened yet. And within 48 hours, they sold out every unit. And I have to admit, it was a lot of fun because we knew everybody. It was my whole neighborhood, all our friends. We met by the pool every night and barbecued and big party room. We would go in and watch baseball games and football games and all be together. It was a good time because we made the best out of a terrible situation. And everybody was in your boat. And that's all you would talk about is, what are you doing? What are y'all going to do? Who's lifting your house? Who's lifting your house? Are you going to sell? Are you going to... It's just... And then slowly people moved out and bought and refixed and redid. And
but you were in there for how long?
We were there for 2 years until we rented a house.
Patty, it's now 7 years after Hurricane Harvey, and the rebuilding of your house is now almost complete.
Recovery is a small, slow process. Summarize, what keeps you in Houston?
Oh, my husband says all the time, let's go. My whole family is here. I've got 3 siblings and they're all here, and they all have kids and they're all here. And my mom is here, and we're a very close-knit family. And when we get together, there's 26, 27 of us, and I'm not going anywhere.
So it's family. Family trumps all.
100%. It does.
Well, Patty, thank you.
You're welcome.
Welcome, Alex Ramirez. In our introduction, you have given us perspective on resilience and the role you and your firm plays as landscape architects. Now let's get into some specific projects you've worked on in Houston that reduced the flooding that Patty talked about.
Has what you can do changed in light of these increasingly severe weather events that we have been seeing?
The 2017 Hurricane Harvey, Houston, that Patty Denenberg described, flooded her house in a 500-year floodplain.
The codes and regulations have changed, and there's different things that come about over the years. Houston, for example, has, over the past several decades, is the suburban sprawl that continues to develop here in Houston, consumes so much of the native landscape that would otherwise be able to hold and consume the stormwater that we're seeing. But as a result of the impervious surfaces, that water now has to find places to go, right? Because of the massive amounts of development, that water really starts to rise on you faster than you might imagine. So what was a 500-year floodplain 20 years ago is a lot different than what it is by today's standards. And so I think part of it is trying to catch up to what is that new 500-year storm, because we're seeing these storms happen more and more often. I've heard numbers that Hurricane Harvey, for example, was a 2,500-year storm, right? But it's all based on science that existed 100 years ago when that framework was established. I think we have to do a better job of understanding and placing terms on these things. I'm not an engineer, but I do know from a landscape architecture perspective, we are trained to be able to deal with issues like this at a regional level. We can help city planners and all of our communities understand the impacts of stormwater in combination with engineers who can help us understand the volume and some of the other complexities. But as landscape architects, we can help people plan for that.
Do you work in teams?
We do, yes. We often have consultant teams that we're working with, whether we're the prime consultant or the engineer is a prime consultant. We most often work in teams. And so we have very close collaborators and people who we've worked with for many years. The example in Midtown, we've done several projects with the same engineer. It takes a cross-discipline approach. I think looking at it from one perspective and one perspective only is not the best solution. It takes many people to create the right solution and implement the right solution. But I think we all need to be at the table at the beginning of the conversation to really understand and establish what are the goals, what are we really trying to do, what are the strategies we want to take to implement the best solution.
Do any projects come to mind that that have the perspective of this land is subject to extreme weather, whether it's winds or water? And what can we do as landscape architects or as the team of engineers and architects to see resilience in our buildings, in our infrastructure?
Absolutely. I think one of the projects was a project that we started in 2013, and it was a master plan of the Houston Arboretum. Because of the weather swings that we see, in 2011, we had a very significant drought here in Texas. And in 2011, we had over 100 consecutive days of over 100 degree weather. So massive drought that everybody was having to deal with in the region. The Houston Arboretum was part of the region that experienced that. On the flip side of that, a couple years later, you get massive storms, massive hurricanes come through the area. As a result of those kind of weather events, the Houston Arboretum saw significant canopy loss in their arboretum. So the Houston Arboretum is about 155 acres. It's part of the larger Memorial Park area dedicated here in the kind of the core of Houston. And there's a 70% canopy mortality. And so one of the things that we did with that project is we took a little bit of a forensic approach to really understand why did we see such a great loss and what was creating the problems. And I think because Houston is in some ways a subtropical region, I think part of that the canopy loss problem was the result of invasive species growing in a place that didn't match the subterranean conditions. Ultimately, what we discovered through that sort of forensic approach is that the native soils of this arboretum did not support the vegetation that was growing above the soil. And so those two things being contradictory of one another means that it wasn't a resilient feature. One of the strategies that we implemented was to remove a bunch of the invasive species, which is an easy thing to do, but also remove a lot of the woodland cover over what would have been native prairies. And so we ended up more with what you might consider a savanna type landscape. And so changing the landscape to something that the soils could withstand and would have otherwise hosted in a natural condition was a big challenge for us. And so as we started developing these concepts and talking with the city, we communicated to the city, like, listen, through our analysis, this is what it's telling us. We really think we need to take out more trees. It's almost counterintuitive to take down trees in an arboretum. But what the analysis was telling us, that's why we saw so much loss. In terms of resiliency, it was in the best interest of the client and for the long-term health of the ecosystem is to better match the soils below ground to what was going in up, what was going on above ground. And so there's, you know, like I say, a significant effort, a multi-phased approach to implementation, but we ended up taking out a lot of the canopy that was impacted, going back with a true savanna, going back with true prairie conditions that would have existed long-term. Had urbanization not occurred and the natural management of the land, you would have had natural fires and natural grazing hundreds of years ago. But as all those things have come out of that system, that's the why you saw all the invasive species come in. And through the lack of management of that forest, it just became overrun. And then it became something that had to be reconsidered totally. I think what might be surprising to most people is that these savannas and prairies can actually deal with more water than a wooded or woodland condition. And so it was to the benefit of the project. And if you look at the stormwater aspects of this, like we could deal with more stormwater on site than we could have ever before because we restored it to what would have been a natural condition. And so there are lots of benefits through that. And one of the fun things that we were able to do through this project is start to manage this landscape as if it would have been long ago, like through natural burn. So in this case, we actually worked with the city and the Houston Fire Department to bring back controlled burns into this very urban context. And so now that landscape is actually seeing what it would have seen without development. And so through those controlled burns, you put a lot of nutrients back into the soil and it just continues to help feed that ecosystem. And between insects and the critters that come along with it through the habitat creation and the ability to deal with the stormwater that we're seeing on site and what we're seeing on a year-to-year basis now, it's performing much more like it would have pre-development.
Have you worked on development or conversion of the bayous?
Yeah. I guess our biggest challenge is how can we slow down water long enough to reduce the peak flow? And so that's where we work with our engineering teams to design these systems that allow us to do that. So a couple examples is our Midtown Park project that Heather spoke to you about. The first project we did in Midtown that really changed the way we manage stormwater in the public realm was our Bagby Street project, where we implemented rain gardens. The Bagby Street project came to us from the city that city was getting ready to do upgrades to their stormwater infrastructure. And while they were doing that, they were going to be burying a very large trunk line for the storm system below the Bagby Street road corridor. So we were in a position at that time to talk with our client, the Midtown District, to say, if they're going to be tearing up this entire corridor, why don't we go back with something better that's more focused on the pedestrian, that can deal with the stormwater and deal with the traffic as we need to. And so what we did there was, long story short, is we implemented rain gardens, basically a vessel to hold rainwater that comes off of the road. And the way that those are engineered is that you send water into the rain garden, allow the water in the rain garden to pool, and only after a certain volume of rain that you get will that rainwater go into the storm system. If you have a very heavy rain like Hurricane Harvey, we have emergency overflows in the bottom of those rain gardens that can send water directly to the bayou. But in a typical and average rain, all of that water is treated in the rain garden before it overflows. It really never overflows. It never goes into the overflow system that would ultimately go directly to the bayou. Our goal is to try to slow that water down and prevent it from getting to the bayou with all the rest of the water.
In Washington, D.C., they have incorporated rain gardens. Has this concept caught on? How many of these do you need to make a substantial difference in reducing the water flow and the damage?
Yeah, it's hard to say how many you need to ultimately impact a scale of a city. I think with the Bagby Street project, we were able to deal with an area of the district that what was flooding previously. So ever since Bagby Street was implemented, it has never flooded, even in the largest storms. And so at that point, that helps you build a resilient community, right? Because now everybody's homes aren't getting flooded. The amenities, the restaurants, everything still have an accessible road, even in a storm. And so you can start to build resilient communities that way. Since we did Bagby Street, we did Caroline Street, which is another street in Midtown. It's on the east side of Midtown, but implemented very similar infrastructure. You take pressure off of the engineered system and slow that water down, treat that stormwater, and allow that stormwater to infiltrate before it goes directly into the bayou with all the hard infrastructure. By doing those projects incrementally, as you can continue to piece those things together, you will continue to make that infrastructure more resilient and therefore create a better and more resilient community. There's parts of Midtown that still need attention. There are parts of Midtown that still have street flooding in a typical storm. And again, it's part of it is there's never enough money to go around to do it all at once. So we're getting there. It just takes a little time. But yeah, conceptually, that's the most important thing to do is to try to get that water to sit on site longer before it ultimately gets into the hard infrastructure and is carried away.
Can you talk for a minute about Midtown? Was there a bayou involved in?
Yeah, Midtown Park was our second iteration of innovative stormwater management, Bagby Street being the first and sort of our beta test. Midtown Park, we tried to push ourselves as hard as we could to choreograph every drop of water that fell on that site. Heather shared with you in that podcast, the park was constructed over an underground parking garage. And so even with that underground parking garage, every drop of water that falls on that site percolates through the soil, hits the top of that parking garage, that water is then captured and sent into the bayou system. So the bayou acts as a detention pond effectively. But instead of it being a typical underground detention vault or what a lot of people are used to seeing with large areas of land dedicated to a detention pond that's otherwise dry and inaccessible, we made it an amenity. So it's a recirculating water feature for us. Similar to the rain gardens, we have an overflow structure if and when we have an event so significant that water needs to directly go to that hard infrastructure. But otherwise, it's allowed to be flooded. It's planted in such a way that mimics the natural bayous and bottomland swamps and wetlands. It's filled with the native plants that can deal with the stormwater of those volumes. But every drop of water on that site is choreographed to end up in the bayou. So the way that it works is that when we capture the water, goes two directions. It either goes to that bayou through a series of systems, or it goes into a rainwater harvesting system. We have a 76,000-gallon cistern that we collect stormwater in that we can re-irrigate the landscape for, that we can store in from a sustainability and resiliency standpoint. It helps us maintain the landscape long term. That cistern is effectively in line with that entire system, and it takes water even off of that line because now we can store water, we can irrigate our landscape with it. But otherwise, if the cistern fills up, it will overflow into the bayou. And the bayou is a workhorse for us in this case. It can deal with all the water. We've never breached the banks of this bayou to date. And this park was constructed when Hurricane Harvey came through in 2017. The park was almost complete with construction. It wasn't quite done. But even at that time, we did not have issues with flooding. The underground parking garage did not flood, and we had no issues with anything on site. We were all shocked just because we felt like we were in a vulnerable position because it wasn't quite complete just yet. But I think it outperformed everybody's expectations.
So that's good news. And what I want to do is end on good news, because in the context of the program, we're talking about resilience from 9/11, COVID, and then these extreme events. And I'd like to provide some hope that people are working on solutions and that those solutions work.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Alex Ramirez.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you to Diane Barth, Patty Denenberg, and Alex Ramirez. You can hear this and previous episodes of Living Well into the Future on WTBRFM.com, Apple Podcasts, and other streaming services. Subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. Let us know what other topics you might want to hear. Do you have any suggestions, comments? Write to us at lwitf22@gmail.com or through our website, livingwellintothefuture.com, where you can find show notes, past episodes, and information about our guests. Our thanks from me, Julie B. Adler, to Berkshire Ollie, WTBR-FM 89.7 Pittsfield, and the Berkshire Eagle for their support. This podcast is produced by Julie Copenheffer. Our music is written and performed by Michael Copenheffer. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and not of WTBR, Berkshire Alley, or the Berkshire Eagle, or the LWITF production team.